I was hesitant to start this particular cycle of our study. One cycle we have finished, the second cycle we just started, but I have still a great hesitation in starting this cycle, because this cycle of our study is to some extent intellectual. And the intellectuality that is involved in these four chapters, 9, 10, 11, 12, is of the highest order. And therefore, we have to make a very special effort. And in that effort, sometimes the greenery of spiritual pursuit may seem to be missing. Because to some extent, you might say the world of intellectual thought is dry. It is colorless. It is abstract. You shift yourself from completeness to abstraction. So first of all, I seek your consent to enter into this field. And if you feel dryness or abstraction, you feel that it is a part of the process through which we have to cross in order that in due course we again regain the greenness and the concreteness and the joy of the spiritual experience. So let me start with a few intellectual exercises, which will be helpful to us to understand some of the difficult portions of these chapters 9, 10, 11, and 12. Now, the first intellectual exercise starts by a contemplation on a statement which I'll make just now. Nothing exists. This is the first statement I'm making. Nothing exists. And then you contemplate on this statement and you will find that you understand nothing. The statement, nothing exists, when you contemplate on it, you'll find that you don't understand it. I will not take you through the understanding of it because it is not understandable. The statement, nothing exists, cannot be understood. When you find time later on, you again contemplate on this statement, nothing exists. And you may find some kind of paradox in the statements. Word nothing and existence. These are the two words, nothing exists. And the two words seem to be opposite to each other. The last word, exists, makes a statement which is affirmative. The first part of the statement is negative. So if somebody says, what is it that exists? Because last statement is exists. So if somebody asks the question, what is it that exists? The answer is nothing. Now, what does it mean? What is it that exists? Your answer is nothing. We should actually expect an answer that something exists. The word existence implies a positive presence of something. But when you are told nothing exists, this is a statement which you cannot really understand. If somebody were to say this exists, you can understand it. But if you said nothing exists, the two words are sounding near each other, But actually you do not make out what is exactly said. There is a very beautiful sentence in the Bhagavad Gita. Nasato vidyate bhavo nabhavo vidyate sataha. This is one of the most important statements in the Bhagavad Gita. There are many important, but this is one of the most important. Nasato vidyate bhavo nabhavo vidyate sataha. That which does not exist, that can never exist. That which exists, that can never become non-existent. That is the meaning of the statement. Nasato vidyate bhavo na bhavo vidyate sataha. Sataha means of the existence. Abhava is never possible. That which exists can never cease to be. If it really exists, it exists. The abhava of sat is not possible. Asataha bhava, the existence of asat can never be. Nasato vidyate bhavaha. Vidyate means exists. Bhavaha means being. So non-being can have no being. And that which has being, of that there can be no non-being. This is a very simple statement. Therefore, when you say nothing exists, is to be studied in the light of this great statement of the Bhagavad Gita. It is one of the most metaphysically important propositions. Now, from this we can derive one very important consequence. This statement is an intellectual statement in which intellect tries to understand. Because the function of intellect is to attempt to understand. And when it tries to understand, it has only one method of understanding. Namely, the method of conception. In spirituality, the method of understanding is experience. The method of senses is to have sense touch with something. The method of vital being is that of expansion, interaction, pulsation, growth, development. This is the method of the vital being. But the mental being, whenever it exercises itself, its method is of conception. That's a very tool. The only tool that intellect has is that of conception. The intellect itself consists of conceptions. If you ask the question, what is the intellect? Normally we do not see intellect. We can see the body. We can feel the vital emotions. But as far as the intellect is concerned, it is so subtle that if you try to see where is it, what is it? It is nothing but a conglomeration of certain ideas. There are certain ideas which are collected together, you might say. That is intellect. An image of this is, for example, if there is a honeycomb. So many bees are all clustered on the honeycomb. But even though the honeycomb itself has got some structure on which all the bees are hanging. But in this case, you only imagine only the bees put together. Similarly, there are certain ideas which are all clinging to each other. There is interrelationship among those ideas, and by those interrelationships, they are all hung together. So intellect is nothing but a few ideas which are hanging together. But all these ideas have one thing common, namely that these ideas are never empty. Therefore, if you put the content nothing in the concept, it's not a concept. Every concept has a content, and that content has one basic element in it by means of which it exists, is the concept of the being. The word existence is a very important word. The only thing that concept can conceive is existence. Nothing exists, cannot be conceived. Just now we have seen that exercise. We started with nothing exists. So nothing exists, cannot be conceived. What can be conceived is existence. So we might say that existence is the very breath of a concept. All concepts refer to existence. You take any idea, they refer always to existence. Of course, you can say that Sarita is not in this room. You can say that kind of a not. Therefore, Sarita is not here. But if at all you have a concept of Sarita, it could not arise unless Sarita exists somewhere. The concept of Sarita refers to existence of Sarita somewhere. The concept of something that does not exist anywhere at all, for the sake of fun you can use the word. But really speaking, when you ask the question, what does it mean? It doesn't mean anything at all. All meaning is a meaning pertaining to existence. And concept is nothing but a content of meaning. A concept is an abstraction. Concept is an idea which refers to existence.
Existence, you would say, is the quintessential, the proof of existence.
It could be anything.
Not sensual.
It could be anything. Any kind of existence. But there must be a reference to existence. All concepts, you take any concept, you will find Sri Aurobindo writing one line, that existence is not only one of the things that can be conceived, but existence is the only thing that can be conceived. There's a distinction between the two statements. Existence is not one of the several things which can be conceived, but existence is the only thing that can be conceived. In other words, the content of all the concepts, you take any concept, one fundamental thing that must be in the concept is existence. It may have something else, but this element is the one common element in all the concepts. Now, this is a statement which I am making, which will require rethinking and rethinking and rethinking. It's an argument which very often makes you a kind of, gives you a sense of surprise. Particularly when you again will think about nothing exists and that existence is the only thing that can be conceived, these two statements you keep in your consciousness, and it is by repeated reflection on this that you can arrive at a true understanding. So you reflect on these two statements, nothing exists, and existence is not only one of the things that can be conceived, but is the only thing that can be conceived. You might say that this statement is the heart and soul of this chapter number 9. Only this statement. If you ask the question rationally, as I told you, we are at present in the field of the intellectual rational thinking. So, in the field of rationality, the one thing that reason, as soon as it tries to conceive, it does only one thing, the conception of existence. Goes the concept of existence. I'll repeat for your sake what I told just now, but in a different manner, at the right time, so you not miss it. Now let us consider what is existence. The first statement we made was the only thing that can be conceived is existence. Now we analyze further and ask ourselves, let us try to clarify to ourselves what is existence. Now to understand this concept of existence, I will give you a story of a debate which has been going on in the history of thought regarding the proof of the existence of God. The debate is about existence of God. Therefore, there is naturally the debate on the question of existence. So this is one of the best ways of understanding the contents of the idea of existence. This question was very important in the West, also in the East. Both in the West and the East, all people who have been concerned about intellectual development have raised this question. Can you intellectually prove the existence of God? This is the question which has been raised both in the East and the West. Can you intellectually prove the existence of God? Now, it is true that many people have claimed that you can experience God, you can see God face to face, you can talk to Him, you can come into contact with Him, you can feel Him. But many people say, well, that may be possible for some mystics and some very advanced spiritual people. But when we are not in that stage, is it still possible for us to be sure that God exists? When you have experience of God, of course you will never doubt it. There is no question about it. But we who do not have that experience, can we have at all this experience, at least at the intellectual level, so that we can be sure that God exists? Now, this question is very important because in India, at least, there is a very strong view that even those people who are at the lower level of consciousness, and for whom the travel to spiritual experience is a very long work of travel, it is very useful if they simply hear the sentence, God exists. If simply they hear the word, simply these two words, God exists, it makes all the difference to life. We are hearing. Once you hear that God exists, you can no more be what you were before hearing this sentence. Because once you hear this statement, you have to react to it. This is what happens always. When you hear something, you react to it. When you react, you have to ask whether what you heard is right or wrong. Now, to prove that it is wrong is very difficult. To prove that it is right is also very difficult. Because God, who is mentioned in that statement, is supposed to be invisible. If it was God was something which can be seen, the question can be settled very soon after hearing it. We can take somebody to that thing and show here it is, and the matter is over. But God being invisible, how do you deal with the statement God exists? You just hear it simply. Do no other exercise of spiritual development, intellectual development, nothing. You just hear the words God exists. And the moment you hear these words, immediately there has to be a reaction. And the reaction is to show whether it is true or it is not true. And since God is invisible, it is very difficult to either to show that it is true or to show it is not true. And the moment this question arises in your mind, even if you do not like, you are tied up with God. Because you have got to deal with this statement. All the time, the consciousness will go on asking, is it true? Is it not true? How to know whether it is true or not? In other words, your consciousness gets oriented towards God. Now, those who experience of God, they feel that one of the ways of helping people who are at the lower level of consciousness is to orient them towards God in some way or the other. Because even orientation, the once you are oriented means you have a direction. Normally all human beings are moving without direction, helter, skelter, they do not know where to move. In that condition, at least one thing by which the human beings can be oriented towards God, about whom they are sure God exists. So for them there is no problem, but for those who are moving helter, skelter in this world, if they are to be oriented, then they found out that this is one of the best ways of orienting them towards God. You just simply say God exists. This is what is called Shruti. In Indian philosophy, we gave a great importance to Shruti. You merely hear that God exists. And the moment you hear it, it is such a statement that you cannot help asking whether this statement is true or not. And you are oriented. As soon as you ask this question and you can't answer it immediately, you become oriented towards it. And until you resolve it, you cannot rest peacefully. It will go on. Even if you set aside for some time, at a certain moment of life, again the question will come. Again, you will be grinding your mind on that question. And you will try to find out ways and means by which you can really settle that question. That will uplift you. You will try to find out as to how to resolve this problem. And then, many ways have been found by people as to how to answer this question. Of course, the best answer is when you raise yourself to such a level that you experience God, then there is no question. The question is answered. But till that time, there is a mill which has been started by mere Shruti. God exists. Now, many people are there who simply will say, I believe in it. Whether it is proved, not proved, I believe in it. So some people can work throughout their life in an orientation on the assumption that God exists. This is called belief. A belief is that for which you do not have complete proof, but yet you somehow feel comfortable with holding that idea. And you say to yourself, I will continue on the assumption that God exists. Which is also helpful. This is from where the whole idea of faith arises. When you hear the word God exists, you may either put a question, is it true, is it false? Or you may say, well, since the word has been heard and it has come from some very great man or great person who has spoken it, Therefore, I believe in it. Now, this belief is maybe only intellectual, but also it may be much deeper. Without your knowing, there is something in you which feels happy. There is Shraddha in you. There is an element of Shraddha in our consciousness. Now, many people believe that there is no such thing as Shraddha at all, anywhere in our human consciousness. And they are welcome to that view. But there are some people who experience Shraddha in them. That the very fact that this word has been spoken to me by somebody who is worthy of great reverence, and he says God exists, your heart immediately responds to it. People might say that you are gullible, that you simply have a blind faith, a blind belief. But many people will say, it doesn't matter. After all, I don't know everything in the world. Somebody who has seen God tells me that God exists. So what is wrong in saying that, all right, I accept it? What is wrong in it? I may not have gone to America at all and never seen New York. But somebody who says I have gone to New York and describes to me, and the person who tells me is quite trustworthy, so why should I disbelieve it? Not only that, but this orientation towards God is so important that as far as your life movement is concerned, it makes a difference between life and death. If you don't believe in God, then you have one type of life. If you don't believe in God, you have one type of life. If you believe in God, you cannot but have a different kind of life. So this word God exists is a very peculiar word. It is not like saying New York exists, or Athens exists, or Madras exists, or Chennai exists. It is not a statement like that. The moment you hear the word God exists, it makes a revolution in your life. Either you don't believe in Him, or you believe in Him, you question, either you go on a long search of debate in your mind, which may take 20 years, 25 years, or even if you want to demolish it, it takes a long time to demolish it. It may take 20, 30 years for you to demolish this statement. So that also makes a lot of difference to your life. If you believe with faith that yes, somebody has talked to me about it who is trustworthy, then to believe that God exists is a tremendous revolution in your life. If I know, or even if I believe, that even though I am not experiencing God, God is present here. If I believe that God exists, even though I don't see God, I have to act as if God exists. As if God is watching me. That I am not alone in this world. And this experience of being alone is a tremendous experience and terrible experience. How many people in the world experience loneliness? They are absolutely alone. And they feel as if in this vast universe, which is unimaginably huge, and an individual struggling and crawling on this earth feels that he is absolutely alone, in which everybody, everything in the world is as it were attacking him. From every side, there is nothing but attack. And in this field of attack, he is constantly striving to move forward. And most of this world is dark. In fact, we do not know that most of the world is dark because of the fact that sun and earth have a very good distance, so that at least 12 hours of the day, or more or less 12 hours of a day, you have the light. But if you go into the vast space where the distances between suns and stars are so great that you can live eternally in darkness, because even the light's movement from one to the other one takes what is called light years. So actually speaking, when you look at the whole world, basically, you feel you are in a darkness, rolling about in the world, not finding anywhere, lonely, and you don't know where the enemy lies and when the attack will come. A terrible experience is experienced by many people in life at one stage or the other, when they feel completely lonely. Now at that time, if you know that God exists, you just heard Shruti, God exists, what a tremendous difference it makes to you. Even if you have not seen God, there is an orientation and you know that God is there. And according to whatever is said about God, He is all loving, He is so compassionate, He is so friendly, He really wants to lift you up, He wants to help you, and His help is unfailing, it can never fail. As Christ said, you just knock and the door will be opened, ask you will be given. It is so easy as that. On this basis, in fact, there is a great philosophy of faith which has been developed. That even if you do not have experience of God, and even if you can never have an experience of God, if you just start with the faith that God exists, and since God really exists, your life will be always under the protection of God, and you will always have the help whenever you need it, and you'll be always uplifted. If I enter into a dark room, and before I enter, if I am told that look into this room, when you turn to the left, there is one square table. And then I enter into the room. When I know that it is on the left hand side there is a square table, even though I have not seen before, the very fact that I enter into it with this idea, I have already an orientation. And I will move in a particular way. When I come to the left, I will not move very fast, rapidly. I will move in such a way that I would expect that I will bump into a table. And then gradually I may bump, I may not bump, it is another matter, I may not reach that point. But if I bump into it, I know that now I have bumped into it and it is verification of what I was told. Now this kind of a help which you get is tremendous. Therefore it is said that faith is a very important thing in human life. Human life requires, without even intellectual proof, which may take several years, or disprove, which may again take several years. If you know that God exists, you are greatly helped. And why should you not give help to people? Therefore, in the Indian thought, it has been mentioned that Shruti is extremely important. That Shruti is extremely important. And Shruti is also supposed to be one of the means of knowledge. There is a theory in India, the theory of Nyaya, Nyaya philosophy, which says that there are three means of knowledge. Sense perception, inference, pratyaksha and anumana. Pratyaksha is sense experience. I see with my eyes, pratyaksha, that which is before my eyes, is pratyaksha. Then anumana is the inference. Based upon sense perception, you can infer that which is not before my eyes. So, there is this element of inference. So by inference also you can know. Wherever there is smoke, there is fire. You may not see the fire on the hill. You are only seeing the smoke. Therefore, you can imagine, you can infer that there must be fire. Therefore, the smoke exists. You are only seeing the smoke, but you can infer the existence of fire. Yatra yatra dhumaha tatra tatra vahani. Wherever there is smoke, there is a fire. Therefore, now you see only the smoke, therefore you conclude by inference that there is fire. This is the way of Anumana. But there is a third method, that is Shruti. The third method of knowledge is Shruti. You hear from a trustworthy person, it's called Aptavakya. Aptavakya means the Vakya of Apta, that which is trustworthy. And the greatest Aptavakya is Shruti. Therefore, the importance of Veda in the Indian thought, Veda is supposed to be Aptavakya. It is believed that Veda consists of such a true knowledge that even though you cannot know that knowledge by Pratyaksha or by Anumana, merely by Aptavakya, since it is there, you can be sure it is true. And if you believe in it, your life will be made. Therefore, it is said that you just accept what is said in the Veda, and it will give you the orientation to the life. Now, that is the third way in Indian philosophy. Pratyaksha, Anumana, and Aptavakya. In the West, also this same kind of process is to be found. There also it is said that you can have an experience by senses to know something or to say that it exists or does not exist. You can decide by seeing, by pratyaksha experience, by direct experience of senses. Or you can do by inference. That is how you find in the West a great development of two aspects of logic. Deductive logic and inductive logic. Both are the sciences of inference. You can either by deduction you can infer, or by induction you can infer. By these two processes you can infer and you come to the conclusion. But there is also the third way, and that is simply by belief. They speak of revelation. What is said in India, Shruti, is called in Europe, revelation. A revelation has been made. There are words of prophets or of Christ. These words are revelations. And people have been asked that these revelations are matters in which you believe. And if you believe in them, your life is safeguarded and you will move on the right direction. But there was one difference between the attitude that arose in regard to these three modes of knowledge in India and in the West. It was this, that in India, they developed a philosophy or an idea that what is in Shruti can also be intellectually proved and can also be verified in further spiritual experience. There are two ways of finding out whether Shruti is right or not. Even if you start with belief in it, a time may come when you try to verify whether what is said in Shruti is right or wrong. And you can do two things. You can intellectually raise a question about its truth, its veracity. And it has been argued in India that even intellectually you can prove what is given in Shruti to be true or false. And ultimately you find that it is true. And then you can also experience in your real state of realization, and therefore you can verify that what is said in Shruti is right. Now, these are the two very important developments in Indian thought. In the West, a stage came where it was found that what is to be held in belief can never be intellectually proved. This is one different line. In India, there was a line of thinking which said that Shruti can also be intellectually proved and can also be verified in spiritual experience. These two things. In the West, it was argued, after a lot of experiments, that what is known in Shruti or what is known in Revelation can never be intellectually proved. There arose also a theory that reason and revelation are in constant conflict. That rationally you should not even try to prove or disprove what is in revelation. You just believe in revelation. Just believe in the revelation gave rise to the idea of a dogma. Dogma is a statement of revelation which can never be proved intellectually and which cannot be questioned even. It is so true but can never be proved, therefore it should never be questioned. Therefore there arose a development that revelation is something which is simply to be believed in. You just believe in it, have faith in it. That's why religions in the West came even to be called faith. What is religion? It is simply faith. A statement, a revelation which is made, and you simply have to believe in it. And reason can never prove it. It's impossible to prove it. Also, if you ask a question, can you therefore verify in spiritual experience? And the answer that you get very largely, not absolutely, but very largely, that these revelations were the result of experiences only of Son of God. And you cannot have the experiences. You can approach these revelations in the spirit of faith, in the spirit of piety, in the spirit of sacredness, spirit of holiness, but experiencing that is impossible. So verification in spiritual experience of the contents of revelation was denied. As a result, those who maintain that all knowledge must be proved intellectually, they came to discard all revelations. There was a sharp quarrel between the intellectuals and the religionists. Those who believe that religion is a mere matter of faith, it has just to be taken for granted, and you have to believe in it. And belief itself is a pathway to salvation. You don't need to do much more than this. What is demanded of the individuals is simply to believe, and belief itself is a road to salvation. You are merely saved by God if you just say, I believe. And the rationalists, they discarded this theory and completely rejected it, saying we don't accept it. What is not intellectually proved, we cannot accept. And this conflict between intellect and dogma, conflict between revelation and reason, is a very important chapter in the history of Western thought, which continues up till today. Even today, In the West, there are two groups. Those who believe that religion is a mere matter of faith and that you should never try to prove or even either by experience or by thinking. And the other group which says that we do not accept anything to be true unless intellectually it is proved to be true. And this number of the rationalists is increasing. Now this is the scenario of the West. In Indian thought, this quarrel never arose because of those two statements which are made, that the contents of Shruti can be both intellectually proved and can also be verified in spiritual experience. If you read the Bhagavad Gita from this point of view, you will find that Bhagavad Gita itself is a book of great intellectual argument. It is also a statement of great spiritual experience. In fact, both the trends are present. That is why the importance of the Gita is so great because of this reason. In the Upanishad, it is purely spiritual experience. In the Veda, purely spiritual experience. There is no intellectual argument. In the Gita, both these trends are put together. The statements which are made be derived from such spiritual experience, but also intellectually incorrigible. Like the statement which I made in the beginning, Nasato Vidyate Bhavo Nabhavo Vidyate Sata. That which does not exist cannot exist. That which exists can never be not existing. Statements of this kind are intellectually incorrigible. Also, they are the results of a great spiritual experience. But they have seen those spiritual realized souls had experienced the spirit. They have found the experience of the spirit of imperishable nature, existence which cannot perish. Therefore, of Sat there can be no abhava. Sat of which abhava is impossible. It is imperishable. Now, nonetheless, I only gave you this background to appreciate what I am now going to say about the debate with which I started, that in the history of thought there has been a long debate whether we can intellectually prove the existence of God. And although I told you in the West, the conclusion was that the idea of God which is revealed cannot be intellectually proved. Yet there was a long development in the history of Western thought when many religious leaders tried to prove the existence of God by intellectual means. In India also, we have many methods of proving the existence of God. In fact, each system of Indian philosophy is in a sense an attempt to prove the existence of God intellectually. Nyaya, Vaisheshika, Sankhya, Yoga, Purva Mimamsa, Uttar Mimamsa. These are the six systems of Indian philosophy which are based upon Vedic upon Shruti. Buddhism and Jainism, which are not based upon Shruti, they have a different approach. They are also highly intellectual, and they are also whatever is spiritually experienced is also to be intellectually tested. In fact, Buddha declared, this is one of his famous declarations, do not believe anything because I have said it or because anybody has said it. Believe only if in your intellectual speculation, in your impartial search by your intellectual thought, you really come to the conclusion that it is true. So, in Jainism also there is a tremendous intellectuality by which the propositions of Jainism, which are based upon spiritual experience ultimately, are sought to be proved intellectually. So there is in India a long process by which intellectually the propositions of revelation have been attempted to be proved. So let us now see at least one example, and I shall take the example of an argument put forward by one of the leaders of religion in the West called Anselm, A-N-S-E-L-M. He was one of the great religious leaders, and he argued that existence of God can be proved intellectually. And I shall now state to you his argument in a very brief manner, in a very simple manner, even if you say in a childish manner, so that it can be understood much more easily. Now, first statement is, in this proof, God is a being than whom greater cannot be conceived. I shall repeat this sentence because it's a very important statement. God is a being than whom greater cannot be conceived. This is the first statement. Now, second statement. God, who is only in conception, is lesser than God who is in existence also. God, who is only in conception, is lesser than God who is also in existence. Therefore, God who is one, who is a being than whom greater cannot be conceived, must not only be in a thought, he must also be in existence. I shall repeat. It's a very interesting argument. God is a being than whom greater cannot be conceived. God who is in existence is greater than the God who is only in conception. Therefore, God exists. Now, this argument which Anselm put forward reigned quite for a long time in the West. Almost every philosopher after Anselm has tried to grapple with this argument. In a certain sense, it seems to be so easy, so clinching, as if God's existence is proved. No question about it. And yet there is a feeling there is some catch in the argument. It doesn't really satisfy. Is it really satisfactory proof? Does it really prove the existence of God? Descartes, for example, who came after Anselm, he formulated this very argument in different words. He said, every human being, this was his argument, every human being has a concept of perfection. That concept may be adequate, inadequate, whatever, but there is a concept of perfection. Perfection at least means one thing, which includes everything. Perfection is that which includes everything. Existence is something. Therefore, perfection must be existing. And perfection means God. Therefore, God exists. This was his proof of the existence of God. God exists. Merely by the concept of perfection which is in your mind, anybody's mind, everybody's mind, from the concept of perfection, he proves the existence of perfection, and by perfection is meant God. Somebody wants to come. In fact, many people are quite satisfied with this argument, and they feel that God's existence is proved. this kind of argument, in one form or the other, was formulated by many philosophers. Spinoza did it, Leibniz did it. Until there came a philosopher called Kant, Immanuel Kant. This argument is, by the way, called ontological argument of God. Ontological argument to prove the existence of God. It's called ontological because ontology is a study of being. At one time I had explained to you the word philosophy. And I said philosophy is the search of the ultimate. Ultimate of everything. Ultimate of all things put together. The question as to what is the ultimate of society is called social philosophy. The study of what is society, what is the ultimate truth of society, is a question which is discussed by social philosophy. What is the ultimate nature of the states is political philosophy. What is the ultimate nature of good or bad, right or wrong, is moral philosophy. What is the ultimate truth of the cosmos and what is behind the cosmos is called metaphysics. But if you concentrate only what is truth of the ultimate of cosmos, or what is beyond the cosmos, that narrow field of study, the study of the being which is at the root of the cosmos, or which is even existent with indifferent of the cosmos, the real ultimate, ultimate of ultimate, that is called ontology. The study of the ultimate being is called ontology. Since this argument tries to prove the existence, ultimate existence of the ultimate, purely by the idea of God, you must have seen that the very first sentence is only the idea of God. It's a definition of God. It doesn't say God exists. It simply defines God. Merely from the idea of God, you derive the existence of God, the being of God. Therefore, it is called ontological argument. Now, apart from the ontological argument, two other arguments also were developed in due course. In the effort to prove the existence of God, there was another argument which is called cosmological proof of God. And there's a third argument which is called teleological proof of God. Three arguments, ontological, cosmological, and teleological. Three arguments of God have been developed in the West. In India also we have this similar kind of arguments. The cosmological argument is much simpler. We are sure that the whole cosmos is there before us. You start by our experience of the cosmos. And if you examine the cosmos, you will find that it cannot but have a cause. Nothing can exist without a cause. The whole cosmos is a fact. It must have a cause. Cause must exist. Since the world is existing, and since effect cannot exist without the existence of the cause must exist. The very fact that the cosmos exists shows the cause must exist. Therefore, God exists. This is the cosmological argument. Effect exists. Effect cannot be without the existence of the cause. Therefore, the cause, namely God, must exist. God exists. This is the cosmological argument. The third is a teleological argument. It argues that there is in this world a design. Design means synchronization of means to ends. All design is nothing but synchronization of means to ends. A certain end is to be achieved, and you put certain means in such a manner that the end is realized. So it starts by the fact that there is a design in the world. Design means that there is an end and there are means and there is synchronization of the two. Since the word end in Greek means telios, the word end in Greek means telios. Therefore, this whole argument is based upon teleology, which is based upon the idea of the end and means, the synchronization of the end and the means. Because there is a design in the world, there must be a designer. A watch is a design. The watch is so constructed with a certain end in view. And the watchmaker makes the watch, the machine, in such a way that it serves a certain purpose. You cannot have a watch without a watchmaker. And this is an important argument. If the world were only chaos, things are happening all pell-mell, then it may be just existing like that by itself. But if you find design in it, it cannot happen just like that. A design necessarily implies intelligence, consciousness. A designer, since the world is a design, there must be a designer. That designer is called God. God exists. This is the third argument, teleological argument. Now, there has been a lot of debate in the West in regard to all the three arguments. If you really examine them very seriously, you will find that there may be some defects here and there. They can all be repaired. The arguments are of such a nature that they all can be repaired. Maybe some formulation is defective in one way, another is defective in another way. But if you can refine the whole thing in a beautiful manner, then you can say that all the three arguments, with whatever repairs which are necessary when they are effected, all the three arguments are sustainable. But there is one defect to which I would like to draw the attention of everybody. And now this is the one defect which was brought out by Immanuel Kant. He pointed out that the great flaw in the ontological argument is that it regards existence as a predicate. It's a technical statement, so I'll stop here again. I'll explain what it means. So the defect of ontological argument is that it regards existence as a predicate. And he argued that existence is not a predicate. Therefore, the whole argument falls. Mind you, Kant believed in God himself. But he said that God can be proved by the moral argument, not by ontological argument. He had another argument, which are not yet expounded. But his argument was a moral argument to prove the existence of God. He said, you cannot prove the existence of God by means of ontological argument or cosmological argument or by the teleological argument. You can prove the existence of God only by moral argument, which I will later on expound to you. And the reason why he said, I don't accept ontological argument is that ontological argument treats existence as a predicate. Existence is not a predicate, therefore the whole argument falls. Now the word predicate is very important in logic. I shall just take a few minutes to explain to you the word predicate. In the time of Kant, the logic formulated by Aristotle was very prominent. As you know, Aristotle was the first man to write a book on logic. Not that he invented logic, but wrote the first book on logic. And he expounded logic. Now, in his exposition of logic, he said that before you start asking questions, is it right, is it wrong, which is the normal question of mind, of intellect. The greatest business of intellect is only this, is it right, is it wrong? After all the questions which are raised by intellect are only these two, is it right, is it wrong? Determination of right and wrong, the truth or falsehood, is the fundamental business of intellect. So he said, when intellect starts asking this question, you must proceed with the question in a logical manner, that is to say, step by step. So that at no time you are trapped in confusion. Because one of the enemies of intellectual thinking is confusion. Intellect, whenever it begins to think, at a certain stage it happens to get confused. This is a difficulty of intellectual process. So if you want to get rid of confusions, your first starting point was that whatever is to be proved or disproved, you first make a statement of it very clearly. Because very often people fight truth, falsehood, and they are themselves not sure what is to be established or what is not to be established. On that very basic question there are difficulties and they go on quarreling. So he said that before you start any quarrel, let all the parties to debate state down very clearly what is to be proved and what is not to be proved. Now that statement, he said, must be stated in a logical form. In order to be very sure that your statement has no confusion in it, he himself gave a real form and he said that if you state any proposition, any statement in that form, you can be sure that at least the statement is logically clear. So in a very simple way he said that in order that a statement is said to be logically correct, not true or false, but logically at least, the clarity of the statement is to be judged if it conforms to the following form. That the statement should have three parts. If it has only two parts, it is not a logical statement. If it has only one part, it is not a logical statement. If I say this, it's not a logical statement. If I say this, It is only one part, therefore it's not a logical statement. If I say run, it's not a logical statement. It's only one part. I am in the process. It's not a complete statement. There are only two parts. Process of what? I am in the process of running, I am in the process of talking. Unless there are three parts, a statement is not a statement. It is not what is called logical proposition. The first part is what is called subject. The last part is called predicates. And the middle part is called copula. Copula is that which joins the subject and the predicates. The famous example is, all men are mortal. Now in this statement, all men is subject, mortal is a predicate, and are is copula. All men are mortal. So the three points are connected together. This is a logical proposition. Now this you can debate whether it's right or wrong. If you simply say all men are, it's not a complete statement. Are mortal, it's not a complete statement. Merely are is not a complete statement. Mere mortal is not a statement. Mere man is not a statement. When you put all the three things together, that is a logical statement which you can now debate, true or not. Subject is that about which predicate is predicated. This is the definition of subject. A subject is that about which the predicate is predicated. All cats are black, which is not true, but supposing I make a statement, all cats are black. You can debate it now, but it's a statement. Logically, it's a clear statement. Now you can debate it, whether it's true or false. This statement is not true because you can verify that some cats are not black. So you can come to the conclusion, and therefore you can reject this statement, saying all cats are black is not a correct statement. You do find some cats which are not black. Or all black cats are black. All black cats are cats. All black cats are black. This statement is true, isn't it? This is called tautology. Tautology is a statement in which the predicate repeats what is in the subject. All men are men is a tautology. And Aristotle said that when you can prove that predicate is a part of the subject, it is almost like a tautology. And there all tautologies are true. You can be sure. All tautologies are true. Therefore, there is no question about debating. And when tautologies are not put forward very easily, very clearly, if you can show that they are tautologies, then you have proved your case. That was a simple method of proving whether a statement is right or wrong. If you can show that a predicate, would you like to sit here? No? If you can show all men are mortal, if you can show that mortality is a part of humanity, then this statement is true. It means that all mortal men are men, are immortal. All mortal men are mortal. This statement is true. Because you have shown that the predicate is a part of the subject. All arguments, according to Aristotle, which are true, are nothing but statements in which predicates are shown to be part of the subject. And therefore, in a certain sense, all of them are tautologies or identities. Therefore, they are true. This is one of the best ways of finding out whether argument is valid or not.
In any case,
there are certain predicates which are absolutely identical with the subject, in which I say all men are men. The predicate is exactly identical with the subject. But there are certain predicates which are not completely identical with the subject, but which are part of the subject. If I say that all crows are black, it is not that black is equal to all crows. That is not true. But blackness is a part of all the crows. In other words, a predicate should be either identical with the subject or it should be a part of the subject. But even if you show it is identical, it does not necessarily prove, if I say simply God is God, does it amount to the proof of existence of God? Proposition is true, God is God. The predicate is God, subject is God, does it prove the existence of God? So mere tautology is not a proof. It may be true, it only means that the word God is the word God. That is all it proves. It doesn't prove that God exists. Therefore, all those who believe in ontological argument, they say that existence is a part of God. And you see all the arguments. I gave you the example of Anselm and of Descartes. Perfection is that which includes everything. Existence is something. Therefore, existence must be part of God. Therefore, God exists. Anselm's argument also you examine. It's the same thing, in which existence is shown to be a predicate, is a part of God. God is than whom greater cannot be conceived. God who is only an idea is lesser than God who is also has existence. That means existence is a part of God. Therefore God exists. In both the arguments you will find that existence has been treated as a predicate. Predicate in the sense it is a part of the subject. Now, Kant pointed out that the very nature of existence is such that existence can never be a predicate. Now, if he can prove this statement, then whole argument falls. If existence can never be a part, cannot be a predicate. You remember I started this whole discussion of this argument in the second part of my exposition. My first part of the exposition was nothing exists. Second statement was existence is not only what can be conceived, but the only thing that can be conceived. That was my second part. And then ask the question, let us examine the nature of existence. And then I came to these arguments, and my purpose was to examine the nature of existence. And now this is a crucial point which we have come now, when Kant says, existence is not a predicate. His famous example was, $100 in imagination are not less than $100 in existence. I shall repeat. $100 in imagination are not less than $100 in existence. When $100 come into existence, do they become 101? If existence was a predicate, it would have added something. Predicate is something which adds to the subject. So he says $100 in imagination are also 100. $100 in existence also are 100. This shows that existence is not a predicate. Existence is something quite different. So if existence is not a predicate, the whole argument is demolished. Unfortunately, Kant did not tell us what is existence. If it is not a predicate, he should have told us what it is then. And that was our question as we started, what is existence? Therefore, the history of argument of regarding God has remained incomplete in the Western thought. After this, after Kant, there have been some criticism of the ontological argument. Even Bertrand Russell, for example, he has taken up this very question and follows basically Kant in showing that existence is not a predicate. But what is existence itself? What is the nature of existence? That has not been discussed further, and that is where the Western thought is still resting over there. You might see in an inconclusive state. Many philosophers of the West may not think that it is at the resting point, at an inconclusive stage. They may think that they have debunked the philosophy of God, and that is the end of the matter. The argument which was placed before the mankind to prove the existence of God has been proved to be wrong. And that ends the matter, therefore, God, about God don't discuss because it is not proved. But the examination of the nature of existence, what is existence? There have been many new theories which have come up, into which I will not take you just now because it is a very complicated matter and not very necessary just now for our purposes. The only answer is existence is that which alone can be conceived. Existence is such a thing. Existence is that which alone can be conceived. The rest cannot be conceived at all. The statement with which I started, nothing exists. Existence is not only that can be conceived, but is the only thing that can be conceived, is now being reiterated. In other words, my statement is, existence is not a predicate. It is true. Existence is the only subject, not only subject, but the only subject. The idea of proving God by regarding existence as a predicate of God is not on the right lines. You should say, existence is God, not God exists. Existence is God. What is God? God is not something which is apart from existence. That whole idea that God may be apart from existence and therefore existence can be proved of God is itself a wrong process. Existence himself is God. And existence is that which alone can be conceived. Therefore, rationally proved. That which is the only thing that can be conceived, therefore rationally proved. This, you might say, is one of the basic elements in this chapter number 9. It was only to clarify this that I took you to this abstract and difficult terrain. I think I'll stop here today and we shall continue next time.
We could have the next time sooner. We won't use the
continuity. That is true.